This is a podcast from The Times.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle issue 774 for the week beginning Monday, the 14th of September, 2026. With me, Sir Andy Zaltzman, live in London. And in New York City is the woman formerly known as John Oliver, award-winning game show hostess and gossip columnist, Petula J. Oliver.
Hello, Andy! Hello, Buglers!
Hello, John. Sorry, I can't get used to PJ. Sorry, I can't get used to that, even after 12 years. But you must be enjoying your freedom again after your release. But,
oh, it's been quite a week.
Always happy to pull a few strings for my old bodies and my new role as UK Foreign Secretary. had you all going there. I got you. You thought you'd just woken up from a 16-year and a bit coma. And that John had had his special surgery at last.
Yep.
And done time for hijacking Air Force One and doing loop-the-loops over Washington while President Bristol Palin was being inaugurated.
Oh, boy.
But no, seriously, it's Bugle 113. Week beginning Monday, the 3rd of May, 2010. And John is only now starting to examine who he really is.
Yeah.
Hello, John.
You know, bury it for long enough, Andy. You know, I'm like an Icelandic volcano. Sooner or later, it's coming out. Andy, I've got some details to tell you about my birthday last week, which I think you'll enjoy.
All right.
This needs a little bit of background. Rob Riggle's birthday is 2 days before mine.
Yeah.
And this year, I bought him a special plant called Simply, and there's no pleasant way of saying this, the grow a dick plant, which is two cactuses with a larger plant which grows between them straight up. Now, the most important thing really is that it has grow a dick written on the box. And, you know, the plant looks like a penis. That's the important part of it.
Okay,
now,
right. Yeah.
Riggle retaliated 2 days later by renting last Friday on my birthday a mariachi band to come to the office and sing me happy birthday in Spanish for slightly longer than was comfortable. I think this is now clearly going to escalate until someone gets hurt or one of us is dead.
That's how the First World War started.
It was, yeah, a misplaced mariachi band. It was unbelievable.
That's right.
The whole office was there. These format, and he'd written them a speech as well.
Oh, right.
To read out about how America was the greatest country in the world and how Britain was basically France.
Well, you can only argue with half of that. So this is the week beginning 3rd of May 2010. As always, some sections of the Bugle going straight in the bin. This week, a press freedom section. Monday is World Press Freedom Day. So to mark this occasion, we'll be using freedom of speech to make the following untrue allegations against leading figures on the planet. The possibly outgoing British Foreign Secretary David Miliband spent the first 15 years of his life fighting as a guerrilla for the Sandinista rebels. Actor Robert De Niro once knocked out an entire herd of cows by smashing them in the head with a cricket bat. German Chancellor Angela Merkel had a long-standing affair with her 19th century predecessor Otto von Bismarck. It lasted throughout Merkel's late 20s and nearly caused Bismarck's late wife to divorce him. And Bill Gates bathes daily in the blood of trainee vicars. All of those untrue, but we are allowed to say them because of press freedom. Treasure it, Buglers. Treasure it. More of that in the bin this week.
Top story this week, countdown to Votageddon. British democracy is back from the dead, Andy, that is for sure. It's punched its way out of the grave like Uma Thurman in Kill Bill and is now wandering the streets more powerful than ever, or at least more powerful than any time in the last 10 years. Where once the fear was that turnout could be around 50%, now, surely, we can dare to dream that 2 in 3 people may actually vote. I tell you what we have to thank for this, Andy. The same thing we have to thank for game shows and omelette whisk infomercials, television. Who'd have thought the TV debates would have shaken British democracy to its extremely dusty foundations? I think what's become clear from across the pond, Andy, is that Clegg has gained the most. Cameron's lost some of the mathematical inevitability that he had coming into the campaign, largely due to making the mistake of occasionally saying things he actually believes. And Brown hasn't really lost anything, as he didn't really have anything to lose in the first place. It's like a man sitting in an empty house. There's only so much a burglary can hurt him.
Yeah, well, the final Prime Ministerial debate took place last night, Thursday, as we record here on Friday. just 6 days away from Votageddon, and the entire future of Britain, John, the nation, the business, the brand, was on the line as the public sat down in front of their TV sets in eager anticipation before realising they were watching the wrong channel and switching over to watch Britain's stupidest teacher or Shoot Me, I'm a Nincompoop or My Aunt Thinks Hitler Was a Horse or whatever else was on before checking the news headlines at 10 o'clock to find out who'd won, apparently, and therefore who deserves to own Britain. And frankly, John, I think the reaction from most people is that the novelty has now worn off. After three debates. Yeah. It was pretty dull last night. Democracy was fun for the first debate, John. It was okay for the second, and it's now a bit passé by the third. And, you know, I'm more than averagely tolerant of democracy. But this was like having concentrated bullshit milkshake blasted into your face at point-blank range. I lasted about 11 minutes of what had been billed as one of the most significant moments in our democratic history before I started thinking, what was wrong with the old system of just voting for who your father told you to vote for? It never did Britain any harm.
But the whole point, Andy, of having three debates is that you're supposed to learn in PR terms as you go. So you know, you look down the camera, you try and smile more, you try and engage with the viewer. Now, by the third debate, at least one of them should have realised the key to winning televised elections is the T-shirt cannon. It just takes one of them, Andy, just to pull it out and say to the assembled crowd, who wants a free T-shirt? Everyone will go crazy, just start unloading T-shirts into the crowd. Everyone's going to think, look at that, he gives out T-shirts. I want to... You can have it on your bus, just an open-top bus, just shooting T-shirts around key marginal constituencies. I'm telling you, it'll work. People love T-shirts.
Yeah, but it was one of these 76 rules that they had governing this debate. No T-shirt cannons. No nut grabs.
What about T-shirt machine guns?
No, that is definitely out.
Right.
That is definitely out. And no cross-dressing. All of those three. Not allowed. In summary, though, for those of you who didn't see it, all three leaders are basically in favour of getting the economy moving, which is good, I guess.
Right.
So it looks like that crisis is going to be averted, whoever wins. They don't really like each other, that much came across. And they're also not afraid of repeating stuff they've said over and over again, word for word, until the nation just gives in and votes. And Cameron has been criticised for crapping on kind of nebulously about change a bit too much in this campaign. And to be fair, he did rein himself in a bit last night. Change was only the 11th word that he said, so he held it back quite a lot longer than usual.
Wow.
And he also pulled off a clever subliminal trick to emphasise the need for change by doing a rapid off-screen costume change between each question. Although he didn't really notice it because he'd changed into 12 versions of the same suit and tie that he'd been wearing at the start. So the change was barely perceptible. Did that reveal something, John? No, because it didn't happen. But if it had happened, it might have revealed something. And that's the most important thing to remember.
Now, Gordon Brown has had an undeniably bad week, culminating in him being overheard on a live microphone calling an old lady a bigot, having just had a conversation with her that suggested nothing of the sort. Now, calling a member of the electorate, a lifelong Labour voter, no less, a bigot, is probably even worse than when John Prescott actually punched a voter in the face. It's even worse than that. The thing is that in isolation, probably isn't that terrible. It's just that it plays into a widely held belief that Gordon Brown hates people. Now, if he doesn't hate them, he certainly has an active dislike for them. He'd have been a great 19th century politician, Andy, when you could govern from a wood-panelled room with a fireplace in it and you never had to touch any peasants.
That's right. Well, he has been handicapped in this campaign by things like the invention of television and the invention of photography and the development of human speech. And they've all kind of conspired against him, and he's struggled to convey his very important message of, yes, we're f***ed, but we'll be even more f***ed if you vote for these losers. And he was pretty unlucky with this bigot comment, John, because someone forgot to switch his microphone off. Mm-hmm. He was probably just winding down, a bit annoyed after the last 50-odd years of his life. And it just came out. And the press were all over it, John, because I don't think, you know, it wasn't that important. You know, it was the press, but the press were all over it, like human skin on a cannibal's birthday cake. And why was this, John? Why were the press so obsessed with it? I'll tell you why. Because it was a faux pas caused by someone forgetting to switch their microphone off. And I'm sure all politicians say that in what they think is the privacy of their own massive limousine. But the press loved it because it meant they could basically not do their f***ing job for a couple of days and just crap on about this comment. But Brown should have dealt with it better. He should have had more balls. He should have said, yes, I did call her a bigot, and I stand by that. She is a bigot, and I meant that as a compliment. Britain was built on the powers of bigotry. It's what drove our empire. It's part of our shared birthright in this country. Groundless and ill-informed prejudice that clouds the harsh realities of reality. And I appeal to all bigots of all bigoty persuasions to unite behind me and the Labour Party, and we will represent each of your bigotries to the best of our ability.
Oh, God, Andy, I'm tearing up.
But he didn't say that. What he actually said was, oh, f***. Shitbags, that is all I need. But he didn't say that out loud, but he did say it with his face.
Gordon Brown actually spent 45 minutes in the house of Mrs. Duffy, the lady he called a bigot, and I would really love to hear those tapes, Andy. I really think he was probably just trying to convince her to say something racist, because all he needed was for her to actually prove him right. I bet he laid it on pretty thick. Please, please, Mrs. Duffy, it can be about the Chinese, just something. If you're really a Labour supporter, you do this for me, please. I need this. I'm in a bad way. Or he may have spent 30 of those 45 minutes upstairs in her bathroom trying to draw swastikas on things. Oh, what's this, Mrs. Duffy? A swastika engraved in your soap? Pretty bigoty behaviour, don't you think? You just did that, Gordon. You've got soap under your fingernails. Oh, please say something racist. I'm f***ed. This is...
I think what actually happened, though, was that she realised she was in a position of power. She started that day as just an ordinary ordinary voter who no one in the public eye had ever heard of. By the end of the day, she had the Prime Minister basically held hostage in her living room until he'd completed his penitence. And I think, basically, she looked like she probably likes reality television. I think she was making him sing songs.
Yeah.
He was basically having to go through her favourite, all the classic Osmond songs from the 70s. Maybe a bit of Boney M. Basically, just until she was happy that he really meant sorry.
I'm not forgiven yet. Not yet, Gordon. I think we'll have another rendition of Puppy Love. And they called it Puppy Love. I don't want to. This is by no means the first microphone gaffe in political history, of course. Prime Minister John Major called three of his ministers bastards. on a live mic, Prince Charles said
Royal again with my, you just you, that was factually correct.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not disagreeing.
He could
call
them shitbags.
Prince Charles said of Royal Correspondent Nicholas Witchell, "I can't bear that man. I mean, he's so awful. He really is." President George W. Bush called Adam Clymer from the New York Times a major league arsehole. President Obama,
I didn't know that was a major league these days.
He was in the minors, but Bush called him up. President Obama, before he became president, argued that some people clung to their guns and religion. And Jesus Christ, of course, called Judas Iscariot shady and a little douchey just 6 months before his fatal carpentry disaster. And the point is, I think as you alluded to, I bet every single world leader in history has at some point explicitly stated that they hate their own people. It's just beyond the bounds of human restraint that it hasn't happened.
Yeah, just off Stalin. He was pretty above board about it, to be fair.
That's the thing. There was nothing surreptitious there. Yeah, I hate you. And I've got a special place for you, and it's cold. Maybe the safest thing to do in the future would be to have a soundproof booth that all candidates and leaders can go to at the end of each day for 5 minutes every day and just scream their f***ing lungs out. And this is important, those tapes should then be released to the public record 100 years later. It would give you a completely different angle on history to be able to listen to Winston Churchill in the early 40s saying, "Ah, Hitler is such a f***ing asshole! I want to stab Chamberlain with a spoon for putting me in this position! Oh, shit, I really think we could lose this one! F***ity f***!"
It's all in Hansard. But the media have... I think they've enjoyed these debates far more than the public, who thought they're OK. But the media, if you're a member of the political media, you've basically thought they are the most incredible thing that's ever happened in the history of Britain. That renders the Roman occupation, the works of Shakespeare, the invention of cricket, and even the Bugle as mere irrelevances in the cultural history of our nation. And one correspondent last night on the television news channel, who'd been watching the debate in what is known as the spin room, that's the media room in the building where the debate's taking place, where more bullshit is generated than I can even hoped to generate in my entire lifetime, and that is saying something. So they're watching it in there, and just after it had finished, the news went over to her, and she said that almost the entire press corps had stopped watching the debate with 10 minutes to go, because Peter Mandelson had walked into the room, and they'd all got a little bit giddy, and rushed over to him to find out what nugget of purest shite he was about to verbally defecate in their direction, shrieking and throwing their underpants at him or something. So they hadn't actually bothered watching the end of the debate. And she said, so if anything incredible happened in those last few minutes, we'd all have missed it. So, point one, that is a big if. A big, big if for those last few minutes. But it might have been Brown's only chance, John, if he'd been asked to make his closing remarks, his final direct speech to a 10 million strong terrestrial TV audience, the last time he could speak to his public before polling day, if he'd just methodically cleared his throat and then looked bolt gun straight down the camera, opened his mouth and belched loudly, resoundingly and persistently before slightly grinning and winking at the camera. Now, that would have been incredible, John. But they'd have missed that. They'd have missed that. And point two is, do your job! Do your f***ing job! Now, as I mentioned last week, the Conservatives are getting the jitters slightly. They clearly think they're not going to win this election through policies. And having gone on quite some length about how they're going to run a positive campaign and that they want to end to the old-style confrontational politics, they have backtracked spectacularly on those claims. This week they had an election advert, and there were a number of election adverts this week, including the BNP, which featured Nick Griffin, the BNP leader, sitting at a desk, and behind his left shoulder was a photograph of Winston Churchill.
Of course.
And behind his right shoulder was an array of military medals. Now,
whose?
Well, I'm guessing they weren't his, John. And I'm also getting that if he wins the election, it'll be a matter of minutes before they are pinned to his jacket. And you can almost see this picture as Griffin banged on with his hateful bilge. You could see the picture of Churchill. You could see Churchill's eyes widening as Griffin spoke, as if to say, let me out! Let me out of this photo frame! I'm not supposed to be here! I think they meant to get the other guy, the one I was fighting against. Now time for the final in our leaders' profiles. This week, the acting Prime Minister and Labour leader, Gordon Brown. Yeah. Now, in the interest of balance, we're also profiling the other leaders, including Monteliard Lagouche of the Kids Out Party, which seeks to rid Britain of under-15s by the year 2045, Ljubljana Stopakovsky of the Revolutionary Tsarist Party, seeking to put the Russian royal family back on the British throne, Darlena Squad of the Smart Britain Party, running on the usual compulsory cravats for men shtick, and Alex Salmond of the Scottish National Party.
Immigration update now, and what? Well, Andy, I'm an immigrant where I am at the moment. Boo. Well, you say that. You yourself, Andy, are a second-generation immigrant. Boo!
Yeah, but half. Hooray!
Yay. In fact, basically, we're all immigrants. Very few people can be traced back to the land they're standing on at the moment. But try telling that to Arizona, which has just signed into law the toughest immigration policy in the whole country. This new law allows policemen to stop anyone they think is in the country illegally and arrest anyone who can't prove their immigration status or citizenship. It's basically a legal invitation to harass anyone who looks like they might be illegal. In other words, anyone who looks Hispanic or, as I'm worried about, sounds British. It's not right, Andy. How extreme is this? Well, the governor of Virginia, Bob McDonnell, is against it. Now, this is the same man who decided to declare April Confederate History Month.
Right.
And he said, I'm concerned about the whole idea of carrying papers and always having to be able to prove your citizenship. That brings up some shades of some other regimes that weren't necessarily helpful to democracy. Wow. If you're too extreme for him, Andy, you're like someone at a party who has Keith Richards come over and put his arm around them to say, I'd slow down a bit if I was you, mate. Maybe call it a night there. Also, some states here in the US are calling for a boycotts against Arizona businesses. There's talk of strikes. The federal government may even go to court to challenge how lawful the bill is. But it's sadly not without its supporters, the people of Arizona being one, and Representative Duncan Hunter being another. He said, it takes more than just walking across a border to become an American citizen. It's what in our souls. Really? hold on. Because it seems that just walking across a border is exactly what we all did shortly after we launched our free smallpox blanket for everyone offer. Luckily, the only person that can help the situation in Arizona has actually arrived, Andy. Now, who do you think that is? You can have three guesses.
Is it Jesus Christ?
It's not Jesus Christ, Andy. Two guesses left.
Okay, well, Moses. Now, he was big on immigration.
It's not him. Now, think, no. Andy, think. It's a key immigration issue. You know, it's going to take a heavyweight.
Right.
It's in Arizona.
Think.
Final guess, Andy. Make it a good one.
Is it Rush?
It's what? The Canadian band Rush?
Ian Rush. The former Liverpool footballer.
Well, just some clinical finishing to show that fundamentally we're all the same. No, Andy, it's Shakira, Andy!
Shakira, sorry,
of course it's Shakira! Her spokesman said, Shakira is deeply concerned about the impact of this law on hard-working Latino families. She's coming to Arizona to try to learn more about how law enforcement is reacting to this new law and how we can ensure that the people in the state of Arizona are not being targeted because of the colour of their skin. A noble sentiment, Andy, to be sure. But hard to balance, coming from the same woman who once sang, lucky that my breasts are small and humble so that they are not confused with mountains.
I thought that was a quote from Confucius.
Well, she kind of borrowed it. It was a sample.
But isn't she quite a political activist, Shakira?
She is. She's becoming more and more involved in politics, as well as being perhaps best known for her nimble dance moves and songs, including Hips Don't Lie and She Wolf.
Did you have to look those up, John?
I'm afraid not.
Oh, dear.
She's a female, less annoying, and significantly more flexible Bono. And if Shakira can sort this out, Andy, maybe she can become our collective Batman. We just need to signal her in the sky whenever we're in trouble. Maybe a silhouette of some low-cut jeans. And trust that she will gyrate her way into a room, fix everything, before mysteriously gyrating away into the mist.
Proof that the Bible is 100% fact news now, and explorers have discovered the real Noah's Ark on top of a mountain in Turkey. Mount Ararat, where, of course, the Ark landed after its little cruise. They discovered this wooden structure, apparently, and carbon dating has proved that it is nearly 5,000 years old, around the same time the Ark is said to have been afloat. And Yong Wing Chung, who is a member of the 15-strong team from Noah's Ark Ministries International, which, you know, suggests that they didn't chance upon this entirely. He said, it's not 100% that it's Noah's Ark, but we think it is 99.9% that it is it.
Wow, that's a significantly higher number than I thought he was going to say there, Andy, and that I think he can back up with facts.
Yeah. So apparently it's all there. It's it doesn't look exactly like an ark, but, you know, it's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I guess the questions are, was it cleaned out, you know?
Yes.
Because, I mean, it must have needed a clean. Maybe that's why he abandoned it on Ararat rather than trying to get it home and use it again. I don't know, because you would have thought, well, there's a business opportunity here. This is a historic vessel. Yep. People are going to want to see this. They're going to want to use it. I mean, in terms of the leisure industry, it could have been a real money spin of the Ark. But clearly it was foul, and he just left it right on top of a mountain. And also, we have to ask, the reason this happened was God decided to flood the earth after realising how corrupt it had become. And you do have to hope he's not still paying attention, because if he is, I suggest you all buy a rubber inflatable ark, because he must be thinking of doing it again. It's a bit extreme, John, as a way of dealing with corruption. Have you thought, God being all-powerful, he could have just introduced a tougher regulatory system? You know, I know the IMF are talking about trying to flood Greece. But, you know, I just think it's a sledgehammer to crack a nut. And it also, it could be someone else's ark. I mean, are we to assume that Noah's the only guy with an ark?
I'm just staggered, Andy, that you've made it this far into the story without doing an archaeology pun.
All right.
I was just waiting for it.
Well, no.
You've gone soft, mate.
I'm beyond that, mate. I'm beyond that. I'm a much more mature comedian now.
It was... Since when? it was Chinese and Turkish evangelical explorers who say they found Noah's Ark. Now, I had two very quick, very visceral responses to this. One, no, they didn't. And two, what the f*** is an evangelical explorer, Andy? I'll explore, sure, but only for Christian artefacts. If we stumble over any huge Viking or Mayan or Egyptian finds, then I'm afraid I'm just going to have to bury them because I'm not interested.
Bugle feature section now, and political books. And, well, with the exciting news that George W. Bush's memoirs are coming out in November, November the 9th, they're going to be released, unleashed.
I think that is technically the term for this. Then they've got a warehouse full of books on a massive leash.
Yeah. And to commemorate this, we have an exclusive free pre-publication excerpt from Bush's memoirs. This comes from a key moment of the Bush administration, when the President and Vice President Dick Cheney discussed the possible invasion of Iraq. March the 18th, 2003, war was looming, and this is where we pick up the memoirs. I won't do the voice. Dick rode into the Oval Office on his new scooter. It was a Vespa PX200. This baby gives me a great little ride every time, he cooed. Just perfect for nipping about town. Getting to work has never been so much fun. He took off his leathers to reveal a mind-blowingly smart new suit from Hugo Boss. Gee, that pink and orange pinstripe really suits you, Dick, I said, admiringly photographing it with my Canon Fantaspic BS900. Easily the most flexible and usability-friendly camera I've ever owned. Who would have thought they could improve on the Fantaspic BS800, I thought to myself. Thanks, Mr. President, said Dick, signing some autographs for my office staff with his new Mont Blanc Meisterschreibler fountain pen, its solid gold nib playing in the light from the Oval Office's brand new Philip Stark Illuminanzio floor lamp. I'm getting terrific write quality from this, he purred, his Casio FU2 digital watch gently clanking the top of the desk plastically as the hourly bleep bleeped right on the hour, as always. So, I said, Iraq, how about it? Dick stroked his chin, freshly slaved with his Face Tools Pro Individuo chainsaw. His skin felt soft, so soft on the ends of his digitated fingertip protectors that he now wore habitually. Never again would Dick Cheney suffer the pain of accidentally trapping his fingers in a sandwich box. All thanks to digitated. Yeah, let's give it a crack, he laughed. Why the f*** not, he added, flexing the bicep so beautifully sculpted by his Michelangelo arm personal upper limb perfectionizer. What could possibly go wrong? They've got no Air Force, no Navy, basically no Army. I reckon I could take the lot of them, armed only with my old flopsy-daisy field hockey stick. Great, I said. Then I'm glad I had this done. I tore open my Caspar Weinberger feminine range blouse to reveal a gleaming new tattoo reading Saddam Hussein, 1950-odd to 2003. Wow, said Dick, removing his snoop-a-doop Samovoyer pro-tinted binoculars to take a closer look. Vibrant colours, textbook definition, and rapidly healing scar tissue. That looks like the work of Mick and Ann's body art and piercing parlour just off Pennsylvania Avenue. Sure it is, I gushed proudly. Wait till you see that what they've done to Rumsfeld's nipples. I didn't know you could still get real ivory. So there it is. Sounds like he's...
Well, that's just good.
I just don't want that much product placement in the political memoir.
Well, there's that. I mean, there's that. But, you know, it's not what I was expecting. Maybe history is going to judge him differently.
Also in political books, the former Chilean president Augusto Pinochet is to release a volume of erotic short stories.
Please tell me you don't have an extract from that, Andy. Please.
Well, I haven't translated it yet.
Okay, good. Don't.
Next week. The one with Mrs. Thatcher. Wow, yeah. And also in political publishing news, two amazing things happen in cyberspace on Wednesday, John. Hugo Chavez has started his own Twitter feed, John.
Oh, yeah?
He will now be communicating his nonsense in 140 characters or less to the entire world. And in response to this, I have started the official Bugle Twitter feed, which is at Hello Buglers, I believe is the terminology. Because if Chavez can spout his garbage to the entire universe, then so can we. This is the official Bugle feed. Now, I'm not a Twitter fan, John. In fact,
You've said as much before.
Well, I do think of it as the harbinger of the end of civilization.
Okay, so now you are getting on that horse of the apocalypse, are you?
But the way I see it, on Twitter there are a lot of people writing about boring stuff that is happening.
Right.
So we in the bullshit community have the duty to fight back by writing about interesting stuff that is not happening. The backlash begins here. This is our Dunkirk, John. This is our Dunkirk. So do follow at Hello Buglers, and you can find out all the latest things that aren't happening in the world. Your emails now, and this one comes on the subject of John's political career.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. All right, dear Jandy, brackets apologies. I felt you deserved a good portmanteauing, and I don't think you really look like an Andon. Whilst Googling idly, as I often do, the phrase John Oliver erection.
What? What? Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
I just,
whoa.
distracted, don't think about it. A distracted Digit led instead to a search of John Oliver election. I was just about to correct the error and resume my so far fruitless search for some candid snaps of John and Little John when my eyes fell on the following link. www.hostings.com/John-Oliver. And this link takes you to a page saying self-employed businessman John Oliver will be standing for the British National Party in Hereford.
No!
Wait, you are self-employed? Pretty much.
Oh, no!
Businessman might be pushing it a bit far.
Who is this f***er? Hold on, I'm going to look him up now. John Oliver. Oh, God, I can't believe it. It's John Oliver, BNP.
Yep.
Yeah, here he is. Oh, look at that little turd. Oh, no, that is a disaster. Mr. Oliver said his campaign will focus around the national themes of supporting British troops, getting out of Afghanistan, halting the immigration swindle, restoring the local economy. It's a swindle, Andy.
So there you go.
What an industrial strength douchebag.
That's you, John. That is you.
You've never seen us in the same place.
No, I've not. He continues. In the past, the Buglers have taken a stance against the c***s, twats, f***dards and misguided halfwits that make up this, quotes, political party. I require strong assertions that John is working in some kind of double agent role. And if he wins, the seat will instantly cross the floor to some party more deserving of his support. Yours, deliberately mistaking a BNP candidate for half of the Bugle so I could justify be used the word c*** in an email. Richard Powell.
Email now from Amy Chambers. Who says, dear Chris, Andy and John, in the order that your names become an acrostic for my baby brother's nickname for a single bollock. Wow.
That is
that is a huge start to an email. In times of stress, I always have dreams about celebrities. It usually happens during exams. Andy and John have joined these illustrious ranks. I had an exam this morning and used the podcast as my alarm clock. Upon waking, I fell promptly back to sleep.
You!
I had this humdinger of a dream. Woven for me, partly, I suppose, by their voices, and partly because of my awful pop culture exam-fevered brain. Okay. John is standing in a kind of sepia-toned cityscape. He's wearing John Lennon clothes. His hair looks odd. I look closer and realise he's tied it blonde and has a severe centre parting. It now looks like his head has been thatched with straw. He's talking to himself. Then Andy approaches him on the bridge. Andy's got brown flowing hair and is very, very short. John and Andy talk excitedly for a while. Then the band Status Quo approaches over the bridge, holding their guitars. John starts walking away, but Andy starts fending Status Quo off, his arms outstretched. His defensive motions become hypnotically rhythmic, and he ends up waltzing with the ponytailed one from Status Quo, while John looks on in disgust from a distance. Andy says, I'm sure I must have made this bit up. I'm sorry, John, I've always been a fan. That is outstanding.
That is
Why are you fending them off, Andy?
Well, I don't know, I guess, you know, I don't object to Status Quo, I just, you know, like a fourth chord in some of my songs. Not all of them.
There we go. And she goes on to say, I've got this old reprint of a Victorian dream dictionary and checked it out. Apparently to dream of straw means your life is threatened with emptiness and failure. And for a young woman to dream of watching people waltz as if intoxicated means she will be engulfed so deeply in desire and pleasure that it will be a miracle if she resists the impassioned advances of her lover and male acquaintances. Whoa. So thanks a bundle. I slept in late and did a mediocre job of my exams, and now I'm going to be empty of purpose and full of bits and bobs. Bits and bobs. That's as good as one of your euphemisms. I'm set to become just one more depressing UK statistic. If I find out that Andy and John have been deliberately invading my dreams and ruining my career, I'll be pretty ticked off. I can tell you that. Yours a bit crankily, Amy. Well, thank you, Amy, and sorry.
That's good. That's good. I remember you had a dream once, didn't you, about us doing a gig with Les Ferdinand,
no,
the footballer.
No, I took you to a gig.
Oh, right, you took us to a gig.
That was my favourite gig of all time. I took you to a gig. And no, you took me.
That's right. Okay.
You took me. It was me. You took me to a gig at Wembley Arena, and we were sitting in the front row. And they said, "Welcome now, the comedy stylings of Les Ferdinand." And I was confused. And look, and you were leaning over, saying, "No, he's amazing, mate. You're going to really enjoy this." And then Les stood behind the microphone without saying anything, pressed a button on his green sparkly bow tie, which span round. And that was it. And right. I remember looking over and you were just killing yourself laughing, saying, it's brilliant. He's brilliant.
For those you don't know who Les Ferdinand is, he was a reasonably prominent English footballer for the most of the 1990s. Well, that's probably an accurate description. Yeah. But not someone, not a natural joker, by any means. You know, he took his football seriously. Solid, 100% kind of player.
Yeah.
Always gave of his best, very strong in the air, powerful right boot. But not someone you'd expect to be standing on stage at the Wembley Arena with a rotating, sparkly green bow tie.
Best dream I've ever had.
How was the Smurfs last week, John?
Oh, it was great. Yeah. It was great. So I did my whatever it was, three lines, Andy. We'll just have to wait and see if it's kept in the... One of the lines I'm fending off... Did I tell you last week? There's a monster which is like shooting lasers at me or something.
Right.
And I hold a mirror. That's what my Smurf does. And I'm blasting... I'm deflecting the laser beams or something.
Right.
You can tell how...
You really
very
got
well
into
prepared
this part,
I was
you?
For this role. Yeah. I also had to sing for this. There's a Smurf song.
So basically, all the singing you've been doing on the Bugle has borne fruit. That's
off.
What you're telling us.
It paid off. Summer 2011, Andy.
Can't wait.
You'll have
Did you manage to plug the Bugle in it?
I gave it a go.
I'm not sure that's our target demographic, is it? Smurf fans? Bugle Sport now, and tragedy for your team last night, John. Liverpool knocked out of the UEFA Europa League, the second tier European club football tournament, knocked out the semi-final stage by Atletico Madrid. And it was a heroic campaign by Liverpool. I mean, to get that far, I know they pitched it perfectly. It just looked like they got everything right. Because to get that far, they'd had to get knocked out of the Champions League in third place in their group. And it takes real determination to get third place in a four-team group, John.
Yeah, all right.
You know, they really did that bit well. And you thought
you made your point.
That was the toughest obstacle to overcome in that tournament.
I get it, Andy. It's a good point.
I mean, you're knocked out of Europe twice in one season.
Yeah, you're right.
That's got to sting, John.
It does sting, Andy. It's stinging right now, thinking about it.
Yeah.
It's physically and emotionally stinging. My football team is in a mess. Absolute, possibly unprecedented mess.
Oh, well. And it's a little Bugle update now. In Bugle 26, just a fraction over 2 years ago, we reported on, I think, on the world's worst tennis players. He was described in some newspapers. A guy called Robert D, who had lost 54 consecutive professional tennis matches in straight sets, and then he won one. His career earnings were £1,150 over 3 years, which I think puts him well below the global poverty line. There are kids in Africa earning more than him for stitching logos onto shoes. And he launched a legal action against a newspaper that had described him as the world's worst tennis player. And he has rightly lost that legal action. You cannot fight those statistics. And I want to know why he launched that legal action. He should be proud of his failure. That is the kind of sustained failure you should glory in.
Yeah.
Don't be ashamed of it.
Yeah.
If you've got the balls to bother playing 54 professional tennis matches when you know your shit...
Yeah.
Then you should glory in that.
We should sponsor him, Andy. We should sponsor that. Let's get him to wear a Bugle shirt. Hold on. We should genuinely look into this. How's he not going to take some money?
Yeah. I mean, if he's earning less than a pound a day, I reckon for £20 he'd wear that shirt for a year.
I'm looking into this week, Andy.
Let's find out how much Roger Federer gets paid by Nike for wearing their kit and do proportional to earnings. We'll try and match that for Robert D.
Stay tuned, Buglers. I'm on this. I'm on it.
Bugle forecast now. And the forecast this week, John, well, two things. One, will America be completely covered in oil by this time next year? Next week?
Well, yeah, it's going to be... This is, you know, it's the natural element volcano, even though there's nothing natural about how this came to be.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, I think it's heading towards Louisiana, so I think I'm going to be hosed off this time next week.
Right. So, I mean, who's it being blamed on? I mean, is this licentious women or gays? Or was it the Haitians' fault again?
I think it's the boobquake. You know, be careful you play
this
with.
This boobquake is destroying the world.
Yeah, just...
Put them away, ladies.
Put them away. Put them away. Think of the gulls.
Bye-bye, buglers. Happy voting, and don't forget to keep up with the Bugle Twitter feed for everything that is not happening in the world. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is a Times Online podcast. For more podcasts, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.